Back at it Tuesday, July 7th, a very busy edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC 600. Darren Spencer joined us, a former law enforcement officer who now works with police departments across the country for a new angle at policing. That includes de-escalating certain situations. Darren chimed in on that and pointers he's been giving police departments for years right now. 4 o'clock hour, former Bridgeport State Rep Chris Caruso chimed in on the controversy regarding Monday night's removal of the Christopher Columbus statue overlooking Seaside Park. We had a political science professor from Southern Connecticut State University on to fill out the 4 o'clock hour regarding a Supreme Court decision that came down earlier in the week on faithless electors. And Republican State Senator George Logan joined us near the end of the show in the 5 o'clock hour to talk about what's being done maybe for bar owners around the state or still not being allowed to reopen amid the coronavirus shutdown. The author of Humane Policing, How Perspectives Can Influence Our Performance. You can check out the book and check out more about our guest. Go to the website humanepolicing.com. He's a former sheriff's deputy, military background too, who now tries to teach and employ efforts of humane policing. Darren Spencer joins us right now for a few minutes here. Till the bottom of the hour on WICC. Darren, hi. Paul here in WICC. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Hey, Darren, before we get into your book and your website and what you do for a living, what was your reaction when you, as a former sheriff's deputy and somebody involved in law enforcement, when you saw bits and pieces and finally more of that video out of Minneapolis of what happened with George Floyd? Tell us about that.
It was, my reaction was just like much of the rest of the population was, disgust and discontent and just complete. As a officer of the law and a peace officer, not only did he do harm and injustice to George Floyd, he did harm and injustice to everybody in the uniform, and so did the other officers that failed to act on their oaths. So he blemished a profession in his actions. And so, yes, I am devastated by what happened to George Floyd. And I'm even more devastated the fact that it was in Minneapolis, because I reached out to the mayor almost a year before that, trying to speak to the mayor to change law enforcement in Minneapolis. And I was denied that meeting for whatever reason they saw fit. And so I can't help to feel that if that meeting had occurred, then possibly we could have saved some lives in implementing training there in that city in particular.
So, Darren, did the Minneapolis department, did it have or did not? Did it have a reputation of being, as some people say now, a department that was kind of a ticking time bomb on this stuff?
It had a systemic problem, and it still does. And the reason I know that is because I followed Minneapolis for back since I started the business and the book, and I've reached out to them numerous times to try and help them change their culture, and nobody seemed interested in doing so. From former police chiefs, I even reached out to the city council of Minneapolis. I emailed 9 separate members, contact city council by phone to make sure they got emails, reached out to the mayor again, sent books to Chief Arenado. Not a single word back. So in my line of work, it gets frustrating when you're trying to help and do good, and the people that you can help refuse to be helped.
Is this, Darren, a product of all these dominoes being lined up here, say, and they all get a copy of your book and your resume, whatever you sent to them and your ideas, and is this a scenario of one domino being afraid, Darren, to reach out to you because he or she may knock over all the other dominoes in the line? You know what I mean? Was everybody, say, in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, and maybe other cities that you've worked with, is there a fear there that, okay, maybe this guy is right, but I just can't because it ain't worth it? Is that what it is?
I wish I could tell you exactly what it was, because I can't tell you how many cities, how many agencies I've reached out to that were in distress, having an inflamed situation. And some were more responsive than others. But I can tell you, every chief, sheriff, DA, judge, politician I've reached out to and physically sat down and spoke with, are excited about what I'm trying to do, are supportive of what I'm trying to do. And one of the hardest things to do in our society is to change the culture of a governmental entity. And that's what needs to happen. Otherwise, we're going to continue to spiral out of control. And right now, Lyndon B. Johnson said it best. Yesterday is not ours to recover, but tomorrow is ours to win or lose. And right now, we are losing horribly. And we're going to keep losing until we change how we play the game.
Walk me through. Yeah, Darren, walk me through how you went to this epiphany, or you had this epiphany with your military background, your sheriff's deputy background, and now doing what you do and teaching and delivering ideas on humane policing. How'd that happen?
So I was a Marine infantry, and I was stationed in D.C. My secondary MOS was riot control. Then I went into the State Department, where I was there for the World Trade Organization riots, where we successfully prevented that riot in D.C. And then I moved out to Colorado, went to college, and got into law enforcement. And I knew I was doing the job differently, but I couldn't tell you why exactly, because I was just doing it the way I thought it should be done, even though a lot of times I would act outside of my own agency's guidelines and policies, and especially training guidelines. And occasionally my counterparts would be like, you need to write down what you're doing, because you're getting more arrests, you're getting people to talk to you, and you're having way better success than anybody else. And I just kind of joked about it at the time because I didn't really have the time to analyze it. But then I got sick and disabled, and I was laid up in a bed 80% of my time. And I was still reading the headlines and watching the news, and I've always had a profound sense of duty to my country and the community. So I needed a way to give back. And I'm like, you know what? I can write down how I did it, and I manually retyped every port I'd ever taken. And I systematically went through my reports and looked at what worked, what didn't work, mm-hmm. how I did it and why it worked. And that's how I was able to gain the respect and thanks of 90% of the people I arrested, because I approached the job differently, because I used empathy and compassion. And I even acted outside of what my agency told me to do to gain that action. And because I see police officers, peace officers, their number one priority is their public servants. So even if that person is yelling and cussing at me, I'm there to serve them. I'm there to provide a service for them, even if that service is to protect them from themselves. And that's where we stepped away from the service mentality of law enforcement. And it happened roughly about 10 years ago with the warrior mentality training. Mm. And it created an us versus them mentality, and it bred a lot of fear into young officers. And that spawned this divide that we have today, where it's all about blaming other people in a litigation-heavy society and not wanting to own up to mistakes and approach things in a different fashion.
The website is humanepolicing.com, the name of the book, Humane Policing, How Perspectives Can Influence Our Performance. Consultant teacher Darren Spencer is the guest. More with him. This is a fascinating discussion. Darren, hang on. We'll be right back with you. More with Darren Spencer right here on Connecticut Today, 316 on WICC. Trying to get better policing out of our men and women in blue. Humane Policing, How Perspectives Can Influence Our Performance. That is the name of the book, written by Darren Spencer. Check out his website, too, humanepolicing.com. Darren, with a military background, one-time law enforcement, and after he became disabled, he became a policing consultant, a teacher. Darren, give us an overview here. When you see modern policing, and you see things that, no, you got to do it better that way, maybe you should do it better that way to defuse the situation, get the kind of results you did when you were patrolling. Give us the one or two things you think that, as great as the men and women in law enforcement are, what are the one or two things you think that they need to do better or should be tweaked a little bit in modern-day policing?
The absolute number one thing they need to do is they need to slow down. And law enforcement agencies across the country are so under, they have a lot of positions open, so they're understaffed, and they're addressing the same call load as they would with full staff. And so they're rushing from call to call to address these situations. And they're tired, they're exhausted. As your numbers deplenish, and if we keep going down this cycle, it's going to continue to get worse, and you're already starting to see an exodus of some officers in major metropolitan areas. But they need to slow down. And what I need to – the primary thing I teach is I teach officers to see things differently from a different perspective. So that way they can actually understand that it'll be beneficial to them and the people they're serving. So when they go into the door, they do the immediate assessment of, is there an imminent threat right then? And most of the time, there's not. And the next question in their mind needs to be, how am I going to help this person? Not how am I going to tell this person what to do? How am I going to make this person do something? How am I going to help this person? Because if you go in slow, steady, and methodical, because we should be the calm in the storm, because that person or that group of people is having a bad day because we're in their house. And if we approach with that calm and use logic and reason and start talking to people, we can come to gain their cooperation instead of forcing their compliance. And that is so vital in today's day and age with the body cameras, the cell phone footage, which I'm a huge proponent of, because we need transparency of how we do what we do and why we do it, because that is the only way we can have trust. And right now, the majority of the population does not trust law enforcement. And in return, they don't trust their government, because law enforcement is that first stage of the executive branch. So we have to gain the trust at all cost, even if it takes us 2 and 3 times longer to do the job. Mm-hmm. In fact, in Humane Policing, How Perspectives Can Influence Our Performance, chapter three is cooperation versus compliance. It is so vital, not only for the people involved, but the people watching, because there's stories in the book that talk about career criminals that were working with me to get their friends to cooperate with me.
Mm.
And that is the thing that we need to change, because if we go that beyond the call of duty to make sure we gain that cooperation, there's nobody that can say, hey, even though things went bad, that officer didn't try his or her best to have a good outcome.
So, Darren, it sounds like even on a call, as you say, as you get somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I'm getting the sense that just body language and tone of voice and maybe a smile or a look, it sounds like those things, those small things, may have a cumulative effect for the better of the situation here.
Oh, they're gigantic. And we have young officers now, the 21 to 30-year-olds that have limited life experiences that are going into these situations amped up because they've been trained to be afraid of that person they're going to talk to through the warrior mentality training. And we need to get rid of that flight or flight mechanism, because you can't be the calm in the storm if you're freaking out. And if you freak out as a cop, you're really going to freak out the people you're trying to serve. And when we deal with people, we need to understand that they're having a bad day. We're the professional there. And in my training, I talk about, let's say you're in a dark room.
Yeah.
Your eyes are adjusted. You can still see and make out what's going on. But when you need to, you can turn on the light and you can see a lot better. But when you go into a bright room and you turn off that light, you can't see anything. And it's the same thing about intensity when you walk into a room. It is so hard to back that intensity off once you put it out there. So we don't need to escalate situations until we have to. And we need to try and de-escalate and calm people down and give people options other than forcing compliance.
So two people may be waving knives or guns at each other. Maybe, you're saying, Darren, they may be looking for the officer or somebody to kind of be that calming influence and say, guys, nothing's good's going to happen from this. Let's all calm down and take a breath here.
Well, if you got knives and guns out, safety is an imminent threat. And when safety is an imminent threat, by all means, take people to the ground, do whatever you have to do to make sure people are safe. But most of the time, guns and knives aren't out. Most of the time, we show up after it's happened, and we try and sort through the mess to figure it out. And in those times, that's where we can talk to people and work to gain their cooperation instead of forcing compliance.
Darren Spencer is the guest once again. HumanePolicing.com is the website. Humane Policing, how perspectives can influence our performance. Darren, what do you think of some of these pushes to divert some money from policing into other areas, say mental health counseling? I know there are some cities talking about maybe what could be a better idea to some situations, rather than sending an officer out there, you send out some other people or some other sort of trained individuals. Good idea, bad idea, maybe something that needs to be looked at in concert with policing? What do you think about that?
I think it's a good soundbite, but I don't think it's practical at all. Because the reason law enforcement, they're handling mental health cases, is because they have to. There's no other option out there. If you approached every law enforcement agency and said, we're going to have social workers or doctors or some special agency to deal with mental, all the law enforcement would be excited because those are tough calls to do.
I can imagine, yeah.
But every mental health call I went on was because they were coming off their medication or self-medicating through meth or heroin, or their caregiver lost the ability to control them and couldn't cope with it anymore. And so they needed rescuing. Okay? So let's say you put a social worker in that case and they go out there. Are you going to teach social workers the skill set to protect themselves and others when somebody is mentally and physically and emotionally out of control and very volatile? Are you still going to have paramedics, law enforcement there to protect social workers? Because when I dealt successfully with mental health issues, I had a lot more officers than just myself. Because when you have more people, it allows you more options. And when you have more options, you can get to a better resolution. And we need to approach the training of dealing with mental health separately, because the majority of our training right now, reactionary training, is shoot or don't shoot. And in fact, in my agency, you could not deploy less lethal force unless you had lethal cover, which means I couldn't utilize pepper spray, beanbag, taser, anything, unless I had another officer there with a gun available.
Interesting. Wow. The website, HumanePolicing.com, the book, Humane Policing, How Perspectives Can Influence Our Performance. Check it out, Amazon, everywhere else. Boy, this has been fascinating, Darren. Hopefully we can talk in the future. Thank you so much. Darren Spencer, be good, and we will talk. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Be good. Darren Spencer, D-A-R-R-O-N, spell it right, folks, D-A-R-R-O-N, Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R, HumanePolicing.com. Once again, the name of the book, Humane Policing, How Perspectives Can Influence Our Performance. All right. Back to Where's Chris? Not Caruso, Columbus. Caruso is on the phone right now. Former Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso, still very prominent in the Bridgeport area. Chris, how are you? I haven't spoken to you since the Bluefish Festival last summer. How are you?
You have a good memory. How are you doing, Paul?
I am good, Chris. Chris, are they hiding the statue? What? Chris Caruso, explain to my afternoon listeners who may not have heard you and Melissa this morning exactly what transpired here.
Well, I sent you, I think, a copy of the press release that we had put together, myself. There were two other members of the Italian-American community and five city council members. Yeah. One of the city council members, George Cruz, was going to put a resolution in to remove the statute. So he called us up and he said, hey, Chris, would you meet with us? Could you get a few members from the Italian-American community? I said, sure, let's do that. So we met, we've had two meetings, and as a result, we came out with a press release where we all decided the statue will not come down, and we will continue to dialogue and work together, and we would support him and the other councilmen with other statues they want to put up. One was of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the other was, I believe, from the Pawgosset Indians, you know, one of the tribal leaders.
Yeah.
So we said, fine, and we were also talking about other things the Italian community do. Really, to, you know, how do we teach history or how do we learn from history rather than tearing things down? So I think that was all going well, and I was happy. You know, after 3 weeks of negotiation, it came out well. I will say the very first meeting that everyone got together, we shared opinions. There was very strong opinions that the statue had to come down. One city council member, Maria Pereira, said, I came in believing the statue should come down. And afterward, I really felt we came to a good consensus. And it was a teaching moment that we could actually maybe set an example for the rest of the state on how Bridgeport would handle it. So everything's going well. On Friday, I send an email to the mayor's chief of staff, the email you have with the press release. And I said, hey, maybe the mayor could come on board and say a few supportive words. And at 3 o'clock yesterday, I'll be meeting with the council president. I'll bring her up to speed, and maybe she could say a few supportive words. So everything's moving along. At 3 o'clock yesterday, I meet with the council president. I'm updating her on this press release, what went on, what's taking place. And she said, Chris, I want to be very transparent with you. And I said to myself, oh, my goodness, something's going to happen. And she tells me that in 20 minutes, the mayor is going to be taking the statue down at Seaside Park. And I said, Ivy, 20 minutes? I said, you know, I didn't know anything this was going on. I've been at the table negotiating. We have an agreement. Wanted to meet with you, and now the statue's coming down. She said, yeah. I was at a press conference with the mayor at UB announcing that Bassac High School will be coming there. And he told me the statue was coming down because out of fear that the mob was going to be coming and that they threatened to take down the statue. So I drive down to Seaside Park, and lo and behold, there's a big crane over Columbus's head, and they're taking the statue down. So I start getting calls from the Italian-American community saying, hey, Chris, what the hell happened? You know, we thought you were negotiating. I said, well, we were. I said, but the mayor apparently pulled the rug out from under me and from everyone else at the negotiating table and never told us. And I was very upset, and I said, you know, when does this stop? You know, a group of people who are protesting yell loud enough, and then the whole city government comes to a screeching halt. I get a call from the mayor's press person yesterday. I guess I was angry enough where I guess everyone was trying to gauge my level of anger. And she called, and I said, you know, Rowena, I said, what's next? I said, if the mob wants to burn down City Hall, should we give them matches and hold the door open for them? I said, you know, it's a statue that the Italian people paid for back in 1965, gave it to the city of Bridgeport. There's an obligation for the city to protect it. And, you know, I think she understood that. But the mayor is, you know, determined to take it down, you know. And you know, be honest with you, Paul, this is the pandering that's going around all over the state. And then they take the statue down like in Norwalk. And this guy, Five Fingers, that's his name, and that's the way to pronounce it. He's a rapper. And he gets on TV and says, we took the statue down, and now we've got to talk because we have to unify the community. Well, you know, that happened in London. It happened in Middletown. The list goes on. You're not going to unify, especially the Italian community, without talking to them before you take it down. And this has been the discussion. So the statue came down. They stored it somewhere. We don't even know where it is. And there's no plan in sight of what to do with it. And it was all based on rumors. At 5 o'clock under social media, there was going to be a protest at the statue. There was talk that some people were going to show up and try to take down the statue. They didn't want the statue damaged. This was the police department in the city. We don't want the statue damaged, because then there'd be no discussion. I said, well, then what's the purpose of a police force? If they can't protect the statute, then you know, where's the limit here? You know, the rule of law has to mean something. I don't mind protesting. I think that's perfectly fine. But threats and accusation has to stop.
See,
and,
Chris,
and
that is, yeah, and Chris, that, as you say, that's the calls I get on this show. They almost echo word for word what you said. There's nothing wrong with screaming and yelling at each other nonviolently. That's what protest is for. But, you know, Chris, in the end, it's distressing to me because this sort of dialogue that we're supposed to have, well, A, it never happens, or it usually never happens, and B, when it does happen, it really doesn't matter because it's almost a predetermined outcome as to what's going to happen here.
Yeah, and you know, Paul, I protested throughout my life. You know my career as an elected life. But my mother always told me, even till the day she died, if you ever protest, you better not do something illegal or you'll have to answer to me. That's the way my mother was, you know. She's a typical Italian mother.
Yeah, I know.
right, Paul, with the wooden spoon and the whole thing. And, you know, I never, when I protested, I would never touch, you know, city property or anything like that. And you know, look at Baltimore. They just pull the statue down. You know, the list goes on. New London, they take the statue down out of fear that the mob would take it down. Waterbury, the mayor stands and says, no, we're not taking the statue down, and they cut the head off of Columbus. In Stanford, the people gathered about that, and other Italians gathered and said, no, it shouldn't come down. But, you know, here in Bridgeport, we actually had a dialogue, exactly what the mob was talking about. Let's talk and work it out. Well, we had a dialogue, and we worked it out, and the mayor is the guy who pulls the rug out from under me. And then I read on top of it, the city council president, in her press release with the mayor, condones it, accepts it. And in that press release, the mayor says, well, we should respect other ethnic groups, other cultures. Well, you know what? Then what about respecting the Italian?
Yeah, you see,
we've done a hell of a lot for these communities. Believe me, we have. And to be treated like this is just insulting.
Chris, I don't think that there is an understanding by some. I mean, look, people understand it to a point. But for people, Chris, who criticize the statues, and I'm just saying this from an objective point of view here. Yes, I'm Italian. I'm 100%. But I think I can say this pretty fairly. And you've known me back from the first time I was with the station. I'm a pretty fair guy.
Yep.
I don't think, Chris, there is an understanding among some people of how the image of Christopher Columbus is tied to the ethnicity of the Italian people. You can talk about all these statues of Washington and Lincoln and Jackson and all these Confederate leaders who, granted, did some horrible things looking back there. But, Chris, I was thinking about this before I went on the show today. I don't think there is an image of an explorer or a leader that is so connected to an ethnicity as Columbus is to Italians. It just doesn't exist.
And you know, Paul, my grandfather, Joseph was his name, he was dying of colon cancer. He lived in Bridgeport. And my mother every day would take him to Seaside Park because he loved the water. You know, he loved sitting there. And he picked out the spot. It had to be near Columbus. Nowhere else. It wasn't near the Elias Howe. It wasn't near P.T. Barnum. It had to be Columbus. Mm-hmm. And when I met with the city council members and all, I said, he was Italian. We're Italian. We celebrate his contribution to world history. You know, and they looked at me, and then they started to get it. I said, you really have to appreciate that. And I said, all the history about Columbus, there's all versions.
Yeah.
And you know, with history, and I even told them, you take the statue down, it's not going to feed a person. It's not going to educate a child. It's not going to help people pay their bills. It's symbolic. So you take the statue down, but you don't listen to the history of who Columbus was and all the things involved with his exploration. And I think that seems to be the biggest problem, beyond just being Italian, about the history of Columbus. It's easy to parrot the words killer, colonizer. That's all easy. And I said to the group, you know, the Pequot Indians annihilated the Mohegan Indians. And I said it was based on English colonization. Britain was trying to colonize this part of the country. I said, so should we march on the casino and demand the Pequot Indians take down their casino?
And apparently the Brits were paying them off. Yeah, Chris, hang on. I got to do traffic and weather together here. We'll come back. Chris Caruso's on the line. Chris, hang on. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. A couple of more minutes here with former state rep Chris Caruso, still very prominent in the Italian-American community here in Bridgeport, talking about the takedown yesterday. Actually, it finished late yesterday afternoon around 7 last night, the takedown of the Christopher Columbus statue at Seaside Park. So, Chris, we don't know where the statue is right now?
Well, I do know where it is, but I don't want to announce it publicly, I do know where it is, yeah.
Don't say. Yeah. So it's not worth the scavenger hunt because you would win, is what you're saying.
No, that's right. I'll just give a clue. It's a smelly area. That's what I'll leave
okay.
with.
Okay. All right. But is it it's in one piece, and now the decision has to come up with what to do with it.
Well, that's it. And you know, some people say, well, maybe we should put a different statue up. You know, that's up to the Italian community. You know, we paid for that statue. The city didn't. We're the only statue in the city that was paid for by the Italian community. Every other statue, P.T. Barnum, Elias Howe were all paid by the city. All the war monuments were paid by the city. The Italians paid for this statue. We should have a right. And, you know, in Italian we call it cordero, which is coward. You know, a lot of these politicians are pandering, and they're cowards. You know, I was listening to Luke Bronin in Hartford lecturing that the Italians should certainly have other Italians a better reputation to honor. Well, that's not his call to make. That's up to the Italian community. And I resent anyone telling me who I have the right to recognize and who I don't. You know, you talked about Notre Dame Fighting Irish. I'm surprised they're not trying to change the name. You know, Notre Dame in French is Our Lady. I'm surprised they're not trying to change that. You know, you get to a point here, Paul, it's just getting ridiculous. And I also think, frankly, that the Black Lives Matter is being hijacked by others who want to take down Columbus and some of the other statues. I am a big supporter of Black Lives Matter because there are some cops, not all, but there are some cops that have been brutal to African-Americans. There's no question. And in many cases have killed African-Americans, and it's unconscionable, and we should correct that. However, there are some that are using the Black Lives Matter as a backdrop or a front to take statues down and to go against government because that was their plan from the beginning. And so what happened, instead of the politician standing up and saying, if you touch the statue, if you damage the statue, you will be arrested. No, we're just taking it down. We're allowing mob mentality to rule. And, you know, where's the rule of law? Well, what protects us as people of goodwill trying to do what's right? What protects us? If we don't expect others to follow the law, then who protects us?
Chris, if
that's
we go,
what's happening.
If we go to anybody in history, if you replaced Christopher Caruso, if you replace Christopher Columbus with Vasco da Gama or America Vespucci, there's obviously something in their history too that's probably pretty sordid, I would think.
Well, you know, Paul, let's say we honored Enrico Caruso. You know, he was an orphan, and there's people say, oh, he was an orphan, why should we be honoring him? There would be something. Galileo was excommunicated by the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
So Catholics would say, well, he shouldn't be honored. The list goes on, and it just gets to a point where it gets ridiculous. And more so, the full history of Columbus, not just a part of it, the full history of Columbus has to be taught. And it's better to keep the statue up. And, you know, for my friends out there who are part of the mob, they will never erase, as hard as they try, they will never power wash Christopher Caruso from history. He's too significant a figure in world history. They will never power wash him. And these some in the Puerto Rican community, how he killed the Native Indians of Puerto Rico. You know, that's another part of the history. The tallest statue to Columbus is in Puerto Rico. It is taller than the Statue of Liberty. On November 20th, they have Columbus Day. In the Dominican Republic, the largest monument to Columbus is there. It's a big tourist attraction. As a matter of fact, Christopher Columbus and his brother Diego are believed to have been buried there. So, you know, again, I think we have to keep history in perspective. We have to keep it in context. But most importantly, we can't succumb to mob rule. Because if we do that, what is next, Paul? You know, I said to the mayor's person the other day, so when they decide to burn City Hall, let's stand outside, give them the matches, and hold the door open so it doesn't hit them on their way in.
Now, Chris, you're right.
Where does this stuff end?
And it's you're just, right.
You know, I'm a linguine-eating, card-carrying Italian, you know,
as
you are and others, okay?
I know.
And I resent, Paul, I resent that people sit there and tell me what I should honor as an Italian-American, who I should. And let me tell you, you know, like the statue in New Haven, the Italians, many average people, raised money in 1892, which wasn't easy for Italians.
Yeah.
They raised the money and they put the statue
on the on the 400th anniversary. Yeah. Chris, I'm short on time. Chris, I'm short on time. I've got to go. But if Chris, stay in touch. Let us know. Yep. The phones are always open here if anything breaks on this. Chris Caruso, thanks.
Okay.
Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso, friend of the radio station for years. And he'll keep us up to date with the Columbus statue, which apparently he and some people know. Well, people obviously know where it is. It's not floating out in Long Island Sound, but we'll continue to cover this for you. At Southern Connecticut State University, Professor Tess Marchant Shapiro. Professor, hi. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Boy, often we don't see the Supreme Court voting unanimously on something, but this had to do with faithless electors. Now, I guess, Professor, people should know that the electors we hear about in presidential elections, they're actual people, right? They exist. Talk a little about that.
Well, so the Constitution was set up at a time when they actually didn't really believe in democracy in terms of the people electing the president. They thought that some elite would do a better job of choosing the president. And so the system was put into place in the Constitution that the state legislators would vote for these electors who couldn't be holding federal office, but would be among the elite and know who the leaders at the national level were, and they would vote for who they thought would be the best president.
So they were, in a sense, considered the literati of their day. In other words, yeah, the peons are voting here, but we're the ones that cast the actual vote, correct?
Yeah, exactly. They're the ones who were wise and understood the character of the people involved, where, I mean, we living in Connecticut wouldn't know who those national leaders are personally, and so they trusted the elite more.
And, of course, the electors, professors, you know, they actually vote after the popular vote happens, and we see that, I guess, with that ceremonial box or whatever it is that they bring into the House. But what is the concept of a faithless elector, and what did the High Court have to rule on regarding that?
So it's funny, the term faithless elector actually is something that gets pulled up every time there's a group of people who want to get rid of the Electoral College. And so they criticize the Electoral College by using this term faithless elector. A faithless elector is someone who was elected by a particular party and so is supposed to be supporting the nominee of that party, but then decides to vote for someone else instead.
Which is kind of weird, right? I mean, has that ever really happened in society? Was I correct in reading that that does happen every so often, or did or not?
Yeah, it's happened throughout the history of the United States. Not anything new.
So, and what is the logic that these electors knew, use, Professor? What is their logic, knowing that, I guess, they went against the job they had? Explain this out.
Well, if you were thinking about it from the founders' perspective, they would be doing precisely their job because they're choosing the better candidate. From a more modern perspective, well, there was a time like 100 years ago when there was a candidate that passed away in between the election and later on. And so those faithless electors figured that they would not vote for this person who had passed away. And actually, the Supreme Court decision this week doesn't change that. People still, if there's a death in between the election and when the electors vote, they can still vote for someone else. But what makes this more controversial today is that after the 2016 election, there was a lot of furor throughout the country saying, well, maybe we should vote for someone else. And so there was discussion going on between the electors and other people about who else they should be voting for. And so in 2016, there were actually some Democrats, some Clinton electors who voted for other candidates. There was a couple in Colorado that voted for John Kasich. There were some in Washington that voted for Powell in hopes that they could get some of the Trump electors to vote for that alternative Republican instead. The idea being, well, maybe we can get no one will get a majority of the electors, in which case, by the Constitution, it would get thrown into Congress to decide.
So, I mean, obviously, Professor, you know, back in the 1700s and 1800s, when there was not this mass medium of people being allowed to or being able to find out what the election was all about, I could kind of see that. But now, other than the devious means that you just talked about, the idea of a faithless elector, and I guess the Supreme Court, you know, agreed to this, is pretty much null and void.
Pretty much. What happened in 2016 was sort of the brainchild of a Harvard law professor, Lawrence Lessig, who really wants to get rid of the Electoral College because it's not very democratic. And so he was the one that spread these conversations saying, well, how about if we try this? with the idea that if it would cause some furor and people would start taking it seriously, that the Electoral College isn't democratic and maybe we should amend the Constitution.
I wonder, Professor, if seeing that the Supreme Court did rule unanimously on this one, I wonder how much of that was strict constitutional thought, or maybe the SCOTUS just saying, no, you're not going to drag us into this one. Everybody in favor of saying no, nine hands went up and maybe said, no, not this time, not us.
I like that description. I really don't think that what they did had much to do with thinking about what the Constitution said. The majority opinion did a really nice job of giving the history of how the Electoral College and the election of the president has played out historically, and then just sort of ignores what's going on and says, well, but we don't want to have chaos in this election, and so we're going to allow the states to force their electors to vote the way that that they were elected to vote.
There's a reason, Professor Wright, that these kinds of cases always, gee, what a surprise. They all tend to be decided right near the end of the term, huh, with the limousines all running in the parking lot.
Yeah, and they're ready to take off. I think this year there might be a bigger concern as well, since the election is going to be somewhat disrupted by the pandemic and with the increase in absentee and mail-in and ballots. The voting is going to be a lot slower to begin with, and so if there's some other mess going on after the votes are actually counted, then it really might be disruptive.
Oh, so I see. So your thought is maybe you're right. Another message is, hey, let's not have this play out into the early part of, into the early part of December or after the election or anything that happened in, Bush v. Gore with faithless electors back then. So, yeah, I can see that. I can probably see that again. Not us. Not this time, right?
No.
Professor Tess Marchant Shapiro, Professor of Political Science, Southern Connecticut State University, talking about faithless electors and the fact that the Supreme Court has pretty much said, no, don't play around, do your job unless one of the candidates falls ill or passes away. Professor, thank you for laying this out for us. We appreciate that. Thanks.
Have a great evening.
Thanks, Professor Tess Marchant Shapiro, Poli Sci Professor, Southern Connecticut State University, the esteemed alma mater of my producer, Eric, the producer. George Logan. George, how are you? How have you been?
Doing well, Paul. Say hi to you and all your listeners out there.
Well, George, thank you. George, I had a question that kind of popped in my head when I heard the governor the other day saying, we're doing okay, but he wants to delay phase three. Okay, I get it when a lot of these states are having this spike in cases. And the governor said, George, something interesting, and I don't know whether this was asked of him or not. He said he's going to hold off on bar owners being, able to reopen standalone bars in the state, maybe past the 2 or 3 weeks coming up when, phase three was supposed to start. And, George, I wonder, well, wait a minute. If I'm a bar owner and I've been told by the governor, Governor Lamont or anybody else, that, hey, I can't reopen, George, is there any sort of state assistance that is out there or available for folks who may be in this position or not?
Beyond the standard, federal grants and some of those state grants, there is none. And again, it's one of those rash decisions, by the governor that's affecting businesses, affecting those employees throughout our state. I keep telling folks my criticism on the governor's team related to the reopening is that, hey, look, you set the criteria on how the reopening was going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have we're monitoring, right, the hospitalizations, right? Since Friday, they're down, at least as of yesterday, they're down 26. The total number of hospitalizations as of yesterday was 69 hospitalizations due to COVID-19 in the entire state of, almost 3.5 million people.
Mm-hmm.
Testing is going up. More and more people are getting tested in Connecticut. That's another thing that we were looking for as an indicator. And the number of associated deaths. I mean, certainly even one death is tragic, but we have to admit that three deaths since Friday, as of yesterday, is a vast improvement from where we were two or three months ago during the peak. So all of these metrics, all of these numbers, indicators that the governor indicated was going to be used in terms of scientific, based on data, are all going the way that we want them to go. Why are we delaying opening the state? We need to get our economy going. Now the rationale, the justification that he uses, is that there are states like Florida and Texas and Arizona that their numbers are going up, so we need to be even more cautious. But we set up a monitoring system in place where we can check on a daily basis. The first thing that I do when I get up in the morning is to check and see where the numbers are, where the data is, in terms of hospitalizations, in terms of COVID-19-related deaths. So we set up the monitoring in place. We should be reopening our economy, and we should be monitoring, continue to monitor, and watch how these indicators are going. And if the indicators start going in a bad direction, then we can pull back. But the problem here is that we're not giving the residents, the business owners, the folks in Connecticut, we're not giving them confidence. The governor is the chief elected official in the state of Connecticut, and people are expecting leadership. You lay out a plan for reopening, and then on a whim, you're flip-flopping and changing the rules. It makes it very difficult for business owners to conduct their business. They're trying their best to stay open. They're trying their best to keep their employees employed and working. And it's a problem. We need more consistency from the governor's office.
See, I could buy, and listen, I think he's done a decent job, good job, George, but I could buy the extended closing for bars if the governor said, but listen, we understand these gentlemen and ladies who run these establishments, these bars, have bills. They have employee costs. They have taxes they have to pay. Many of them have to pay rent. So, we're going to offer them some assistance. Because, George, if you notice yesterday, the follow-up question to the governor was, well, are bars and those kinds of establishments going to have to stay closed until we have a vaccine? And I recall that he didn't exactly say no. And, again, George, I haven't set foot in a bar in probably 5 or 6 years, so it's not something that I'm particularly tied to. But I'm saying to myself, well, what if a government, George, is going to order this closure? What? And I've had a couple of bar owners call me recently and say, hey, I got my bills to pay. What is the route of help they're going to have?
Right. Right now it's not there. It's non-existent. From the current plans of the governor. So maybe that'll change in time, but right now it's not there. Now, let me just make it clear now. I am not saying that we should reopen our economy and let folks congregate in bars the way we were before in the past. No, we set guidelines. I went to La Fortuna in Shelton, and they had a very, very excellent and creative setup in their bar where they could move partitions to keep parties of people together. So there's minimizing to the mingling. We could reduce the capacity that bars or, for example, in gyms and other locations, reduce their capacity of folks that they can have inside of their facility. So certainly with guidelines, but to just tell them that they have to remain closed until further notice, it just makes it very difficult for a business owner to keep going, especially when whether it's their mortgage or their lease or they're renting equipment, all of those bills are still due. Their taxes are still due. They have these payments that they have to make, and we need to be more cognizant of that. And these executive orders coming from the governor's office, I think part of it is that he's not I don't believe he's getting enough input from the folks that are out there with the people, with the business owners. For example, legislators. Legislators are not given – there's no mechanism for legislators to give directly input input to the governor. I know he's working a bit through the leadership of the various caucuses in the Senate and the House, but the governor is not the one who's going out. I go out, I pump my own gas, you know. I'm going to the supermarkets, you know. I'm out there, and folks are coming to me. They're approaching me. They're telling me what their concerns and issues are, and it's very difficult to relay that to the governor before he execute these executive orders that has a damaging and lasting effect on people's lives here in Connecticut.
All right, George, thanks. If anything changes on this, be sure to give us a call. We appreciate it. Take care. Thanks, George.
Absolutely. Take care now.
Republican State Senator George Logan, all right, joining us again here on Connecticut Today.